body fat is not like a calorie reserve for a rainy day. It's a metabolic organ. It chugs out its own hormones. It aggravates inflammation. Many cancers arise from exposure to chronic inflammation.
Welcome to the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Ginger Holton, registered dietitian nutritionist. Today, I'm so excited to talk to fellow registered dietitian Hillary Wright. She has over 3 decades of counseling and behavior change experience. She's been a part-time senior nutritionist at Dana-Farber since 2006. Hillary also works as a director of nutrition for the Wellness Center at Boston IVF, where she provides nutrition counseling for women and men experiencing fertility challenges. Her latest books are the Prediabetes Diet Plan and the PCOS Diet Plan. She has also co-authored The Menopause Diet Plan, A Natural Guide to Managing Hormones, Health, and Happiness with fellow dietitian Elizabeth Ward, and now has an active nutrition consulting practice. In my last conversation with Hillary, we talked comprehensively about how nutrition plays an important role for women in menopause. We also explored PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome. And if you missed it, you have to make sure and go listen to it. It was really fascinating. In this episode, we'll talk about cancer risk reduction and survivorship, recommended screenings, and the ever imperative role of nutrition. Welcome, Hillary. Do you have a specific passion or specialty cancer work that you like to do?
So we see pretty much everybody with a cancer diagnosis at Dana-Farber, but I particularly love working with the head and neck cancer population because they need us so bad to assess how they are at baseline, because people come into the cancer experience with the same personality they've always had. You know, I always say, if you're Eeyore, just because you have cancer doesn't mean you're going to be Tigger. You know, so we have to try to get a read on what is your usual relationship with food? What are your typical eating styles? And then to try to talk them through likely how this is going to go. That's why it's so helpful to have dietitians following people through the treatment and beyond, because in head and neck cancer, you know, the last day of 7 weeks of radiation, which is really common, you're topped off and it's likely going to be worse for the next couple of weeks before it gets better. And it's really hard for people to try to get to that last day. And then even though they've been told your body doesn't really know you're not getting radiation still for a couple of weeks, they're in it for the long haul. And so we're there to try to support them and prop them up and help them through that transition. So you really get to know these people.
I love that. I also work with people for years and years, especially like long periods of time through treatment. But the after treatment is such a critical time for nutrition.
Yes. So we very often will get people coming to us, as I'm sure you've had, that they just want to understand how did this happen to me? And the subtitle of that is, what did I do to make this happen to me?
Yep.
And so whenever we have conversations about this is what we know, and we refer to the American Institute for Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund as our gold standard guiding light for recommendations for diet and lifestyle through and beyond cancer treatment. And I will always preface it by saying, we're just going to have this conversation. It is in no way meant to make you feel like you did something wrong and that's why you have cancer. Because we think roughly in the vicinity of half-ish cancers have a diet and lifestyle thread, maybe a little bit more. That means that a lot of them we just don't know. So what we want to do at this point is empower people to feel like fertility treatment, my other job, it's very instructive. Be here at this time, do this thing. Cancer care is like that on steroids. Here's the protocol. Come here on this day, see this clinician, take these drugs before you have your treatment, have the treatment, take these drugs after you have the treatment. Stay hydrated. There's so many things that come with the whole process. It's just overwhelming.
It really can be. Nutrition can help make it better. That's the best part of our jobs.
Absolutely. People who struggle more to eat and hydrate through treatment, the evidence suggests, are more likely to experience the side effects of treatment.
Right.
So we're there to try to help them proactively manage these side effects as much as possible. For example, in all these treatments, they'll be told could cause nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea. I always just say, we know these are the potential side effects. Someday we might be able to swab somebody's cheek and say, if you get full FOX for pancreatic cancer, you're going to get these side effects based on this genetic test we just did. We're totally not there. So we just say, listen, let's just start in with the treatment. see what you have for side effects, address the side effects as they occur, taking into account that there's a lot of good medications that can help people manage many of these side effects. But the management of the side effects is critical to establishing and maintaining good nutrition, because I don't care how good the dietitian is, if somebody's nauseous all the time, they're not going to want to eat. You know, if somebody has constipation, you know, a lot of these anti-nausea medicines, pain medication, notorious for causing constipation. People like kid about like constipation, bowel stuff. It's like no joke. It makes people miserable. It makes them not want to eat. You know, we think our colon is down there across the bottom. It actually comes like up one side of your abdomen, across the top and down. If somebody is full of stool because they're constipated for a number of reasons, that might be pressing on your stomach. You might have this visual that, oh my God, I can't put more food in there because stuff's not coming out. And the opposite could be true. It could be diarrhea. So we just try to let people know that we're there to help them along with their team to try to manage their symptoms so that we're hopefully leveling the playing field on their ability to eat and hydrate, which is so important to stay in treatment.
Evidence clearly shows that nutrition helps people stay in treatment out of the hospital or have fewer side effects because we're managing them proactively along the way.
Absolutely. And a lot of these regimens, they don't want to interrupt them.
Right.
Because they have data. Cancer care is very chocked with data. You know, if you're supposed to get 6 to 7 weeks of radiation 5 days a week and we have to interrupt it because your nutrition is suffering, you have to be hospitalized. They understand how that can change the likelihood of this cancer possibly coming back.
Well, then you also mentioned something so interesting, that there is this worry and trend maybe about earlier onset of certain cancers. I know colorectal cancer has been in the news a lot lately.
Yes. And in fact, we have long said, it seems like the only time we see people with metastatic colon cancer or rectal cancer is when they're young, because screening is so effective that if you develop cancer in your 40s, I mean, we occasionally see like crazy young people. Those are definitely outliers. But we've seen plenty of people diagnosed with stage 4 colorectal cancer in an age bracket where they're too young to be screened, which is one of the reasons why they have lowered the now recommended first colonoscopy at age 45 to try to capture more of those people. Some of these things, they just on the surface really don't make sense. But in all likelihood, there's at least an element of this is just the way diets and lifestyle have changed over the decades, that a lot of those negative effects are likely affecting people at a younger age than they did in previous generations.
Yeah, in what way?
Rates of obesity are rising in young people. So we want to keep in mind that obesity is associated with 12 different kinds of cancer. When someone has obesity, they are higher risk of insulin resistance. Insulin is a growth hormone. If somebody has insulin resistance, it means their pancreas is likely making higher than perfect levels of insulin in order to regulate their blood sugar. But as a growth hormone, insulin makes cells grow, whether they're healthy cells or cancer cells. We also understand that body fat is not like a calorie reserve for a rainy day. It's a metabolic organ. It chugs out its own hormones. It aggravates inflammation. Many cancers arise from exposure to chronic inflammation. So sedentary lifestyles, physical activity is anti-inflammatory. Physical activity helps people to manage their weight at the healthiest level they can achieve. I'm not a huge fan of BMI. I've seen it just trash so many people's self-esteem. When we talk about these things like weight as a risk factor for different kinds of cancer, we should appreciate that very reasonable amounts of weight loss may change the course of things. 5 or 10%, not necessarily got to get your BMI below 25 kind of situation.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's always reasons to be hopeful, but diet quality. You know, I am fascinated by the microbiome thing. We have more microbial cells in our body than we have human cells. Most of them are bacteria, as my understanding, and the bulk of them live in our gut. It sounds weird, but supposedly we carry around like 3 or 4 pounds of healthy bacteria in our GI tract that we call probiotics. And these probiotics, this microbiome is as unique to you as your fingerprint is. And those microbes need food and they eat fiber. So the probiotics in our gut eat prebiotics. and produce these compounds that are often referred to as postbiotics, which are just the compounds that the microbes make as a result of metabolizing their food. So those are natural antioxidants, anti-inflammatories, apparently responsible for about 70% of our immunity, lower our risk of pretty much every chronic disease. And really importantly for colorectal cancer, a big kind of compound generated from that metabolism of dietary fiber, the production of these elements called short-chain fatty acids, which are the primary fuel for the cells that line your colon and your rectum. So we've long known that diets high in fiber seem to correlate with a lower risk of colorectal cancer. And I think the assumption was always something carcinogenic, you know, in the food supply or in your gut or something, the less time it has to hang out there, the better. And maybe there's still some element to that, but there's just some fascinating research about the importance of the microbiome keeping the cells that line our GI tract, our colon primarily, healthy. And so that's likely a contributing factor if people's dietary fiber intake is fairly low at a young age. They are depriving their microbes of the ideal source of food.
And having like a lower fiber diet, maybe more ultra processed foods, those are some trends that you're seeing that might be driving this risk.
Yeah. I mean, you know, whenever I have these conversations, like my thought always goes to healthy eating in this country is a privilege. And we have major socioeconomic issues with the affordability of healthy food. So if somebody is food insecure, it sure is cheaper to feed your family from McDonald's than it is to go to the farmer's market. So I always feel like I always have to preface anything I say by an awareness of that. But what's exciting to me to see more programs coming around to try to make fruits and vegetables more affordable for people of all socioeconomic levels. I started my career, my very first job prior to my internship, I worked for the WIC program and got oriented to what you could buy with your vouchers. And very recently, I was talking to an intern and I'm like, I wonder what you can buy with your WIC vouchers these days. You can buy all kinds of plant foods and beans and stuff to introduce these to kids at a young age. But healthy eating takes time and attention, and that's where we can be really helpful to people at whatever socioeconomic level they're at to try to help them figure out how to feed their families. Particularly kids at a young age need a lot of exposure to a variety of foods to get them to be open to eating a more plant-based diet, and anything we can do to help people do that at a younger age hopefully would reflect on disease risk later in life.
Well, and dietitians are so uniquely qualified to be able to personalize recommendations based on ability to afford food or transportation issues or values, cultural needs. We're really good at that.
Absolutely. We meet people where they are.
Yeah.
It's interesting because even in the dietitian world, there's stuff evolving and happening and people having opinions about what we should and should not help people with. And all of that. And my thought is, it's really not my choice. I'm there to help my person. I'm there to educate as invited in to do so and help people to figure out what to throw against the wall and provide tips based on things that I think might make it more realistic for them. But I've never felt like it's my place to tell somebody what they should or shouldn't do.
I want to talk in detail about the American Institute for Cancer Research and World Cancer Research Fund recommendations, because you mentioned that you really go by those evidence-based guidelines, and they recently went through another big review. In 1998, these groups came out with 15 recommendations about diet and lifestyle. Then they did a big update in 2007 and 2018. And I'm just wondering, like, how you and your team keep up with that and how you help it influence your recommendations for your patients.
Yeah. I remember actually reading in 1998 about the first review from the American Institute for Cancer Research. It used to have this great newsletter that was really well done. Everything they do is really well done. Like, I highly recommend their online resources. But the first time they did the review, we need people to go looking for the most well-done studies in this area because nutrition is one of the hardest things to study. And there's a lot of not well-done research out there. So these two organizations, so I always mention both of them, the American Institute for Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund, so people understand this is an international consensus. And so in 1998, they pulled together all the studies they could find and they collated 4,500 and farmed them out to different expert groups to come up with those 15 recommendations. Fast forward to 2007, they had over 7,000 studies to do it again. And they started to look a lot more at survivorship because the survivorship research was starting to take off that wasn't there back in 1998. And then in 2018, they had over 10,000 studies. And the interesting thing is they didn't really change from 2007 to 2018, which gives us a lot of confidence that these findings keep getting reinforced by research that continues to happen. They have all kinds of great materials, but they advocate for being at the healthiest weight you can be because of that risk factor for obesity and a number of different cancers. Physical activity is one of the most studied strategies. It is so effective at helping people counter the fatigue that goes along with cancer treatment, no matter what kind of treatment it is. But it also is really critical for trying to moderate weight gain over a lifetime. It lowers circulating insulin levels. So it's great for your blood sugar control. Anything that's good for your blood sugar control is good for your cancer risk. They do advise that people limit sugar-sweetened beverages, highly processed and fast foods because of the correlation with weight gain over time. They advocate for more plant-forward eating, which does not mean you have to be a vegetarian, more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, including some plant proteins in your meal planning throughout the week. They do recommend limiting red meat to 12 to 18 ounces cooked per week. And yes, pork is a red meat. Beef, pork, lamb, 12 to 18 ounces cooked. So 4 ounces cooked is about the size of a hockey puck. So we're talking like 3 to 4 hockey pucks of red meat a week. Otherwise, more seafood, poultry, plant-based proteins. They can include dairy in their diet. Dairy is one of those things that gets demonized a lot, but it is great source of fermented food and yogurt. Aged cheeses have probiotics in them. Excellent source of protein and calcium. The only time they use the word avoid is when it comes to processed meat. They really don't like them. That's the pink stuff. Pepperoni and bologna and salami and ham and sausages and all the pink kind of deli things, primarily because of a link to colorectal cancer. So it's a really tough thing to study because the reality is people that eat a ton of processed meat are probably not otherwise marathon running vegetarians. So we have to make sure we're controlling for that. And that's what they try to do. So I say to people, I don't care what you do when you go to Fenway Park and have a hot dog twice a year. I would try to discourage you from eating bacon and sausage for breakfast a lot.
Yeah.
They do recommend limiting alcohol also because alcohol is a carcinogen. The more you consume it, the more you're exposed. They basically say if you have to drink, do it up to moderation, but feel fine drinking less than that. A reality check on what is a drink. A drink is 5 ounces of wine, not 10. A 12-ounce beer, that's like 4.5% or 5% alcohol. But now we have a lot of 16-ounce craft beers that are 7%, that's more than one drink. Shot and a half of spirits. It's no more than a drink a day for women, no more than 2 drinks a day for men. But they clearly would prefer people don't drink that much, is my sense. They recommend that people don't rely on dietary supplements to lower their cancer risk because that's not where the evidence is. Though we do universally recommend vitamin D supplementation simply because we're up here in the north where people don't make vitamin D year round and low levels of vitamin D are common. And then they have their special population recommendations. One is, if you have a baby and you're able to breastfeed, it may lower your risk of breast cancer. It may lower your child's risk of having obesity later in life. And if you're a cancer survivor, follow the first 8 that we described, because not surprisingly, the same evidence that seems to tie with a lower risk of getting a cancer diagnosis seems to be best for survivorship.
I'm excited to share an innovative new product. Orgain's highly anticipated lactose-free protein powder, Better Whey, is now available. Unlike animal-based whey from milk, Orgain's Better Whey protein powder is created through a gentle fermentation process inspired by traditional methods, yielding a high-quality protein source. This results in a lactose-free, hormone-free, and easier-to-digest product. It's made with 10 times less water, 10 times fewer greenhouse gas emissions and requires 1.5 times less energy consumption when compared to traditional whey. It tastes really great too. Each serving contains 21 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 5 grams of branched-chain amino acids, and 1.5 times the leucine of traditional whey. To learn more, visit orgain.com. I feel, Hillary, that we should rip the Band-Aid off and talk about sugar feeds cancer. Oh. We have to, because we're here together. So I have my little spiel of how I describe what it is and where it came from, but I would sure love to hear yours.
The problem is little spiels are hard to like communicate how complicated this is.
It's very complex.
The major reason why the AICR recommends limiting sugar sweetened beverages and like added sugars and all that is because of the correlation to weight gain over time and the cancer risk that comes along with it. So that's the primary reason why they do it. We do know that if people are regularly consuming a lot of highly refined carbohydrates and added sugars, that is more likely to lead to weight gain over time, which worsens insulin resistance. That the end result there is the insulin exposure. If someone is regularly consuming large amounts of highly processed carbohydrates that are constantly spiking their blood sugar, well, where your blood sugar goes, your insulin goes. So it's probably not great, but it is not directly feeding cancer cells differently than other cells. It's just that cancer cells are very metabolically active. See how I just did that? It's like 10 different complicated things. But what we really want to get across is if somebody is in the context of an otherwise healthy diet, enjoying some sweet things in moderation, then what they're exposing their body cells to most of the time is normal, healthy, rolling hills level of blood glucose and insulin. If someone is regularly exposing their body to too much insulin, it means they are being exposed, their cells are being exposed to too much growth hormone.
I go in a little bit of a different direction, and I usually open the conversation and say, have you heard of the Warburg effect? And no one ever has, because the Warburg effect is sugar, like cancer cells are growing faster than other cells and they're real hungry. So they're like sequestering carbohydrates and other fuel as much as they can. But I want to bring up like this biological pathway because it helps highlight the complexity and how these are like cellular dysregulation going on in the body and that it's not your fault. And there's also this book, Starve Cancer, but you can't starve all your other cells also.
Yeah, exactly.
So I like to talk through those aspects of it and just try to bring it down to you have to have carbohydrates, fat, and protein to get through treatment. Your body needs those things. And I'm not telling you to eat lots of sugar or fast food or ultra-processed foods. Those are actually in the recommendations to not do.
You know, I think it's really important to point out that you can't starve cancer cells without starving all the healthy cells.
Yeah.
And if you over-restrict carbohydrates, you're over-restricting a really important source of calories that if you pick the healthiest ones most of the time, you get fiber and vitamins and minerals, and whole grains have antioxidants and phytonutrients and all that stuff too. But studies tell us that the average person going through cancer treatment loses lean mass and never gains it back.
Yeah.
That's a huge quality of life thing. It's hard for people to not get the visual well, particularly those who come into the experience with a little extra weight on board. I'm just not going to eat carbs. I'm going to eat protein and vegetables, but not fruit because fruit has sugar in it. That's the one that drives me the most crazy. I always tell people, listen, studies tell us that people that eat whole fruit have a lower risk of getting diabetes. If the sugar in fruit was a problem, that would not be the case. If you don't give your body enough alternative sources of calories, it's not going to just go after your love handles or whatever.
Yeah.
It's going to grab a chunk of your muscle here and there and, you know, maybe compromise your ability to bring your counts up in between treatments, which is necessary in order to get treated again.
Right. Like your red and white blood cell counts. And you also made a connection between how important the gut microbiome is and how we need fiber for that and to really fuel your immune system. And there's some connection to lower risk of colorectal cancer. So fruit fits into that category very well.
Totally. All plant foods have unique kinds of fibers. So this is what drives me crazy when people, you know, carbs are the devil and bread is the devil. I'm like, bread is not the devil. Whole grains have great nutritional contributions to make. It's all about, and I talk about this a lot in my books when I talk about insulin resistance, carbohydrates are about the two Qs. It's the quality, where are those carbohydrates coming from most of the time, and the quantity, how much are you eating? That's why I love the balanced plate visuals, like the New American Plate from the American Institute for Cancer Research. They have some beautiful visuals for that on their website. It just shows that there's a role to play for all of these different things that you see on this plate. None of them is dispensable. You know, you need protein. And when you're going through the cancer treatment experience, you need to make sure you're getting enough protein, because having the disease is going to raise your nutritional needs. Then we hit you with all these treatments that are going to further increase the amount of food that you need in order to maintain a stable weight, which is largely a reflection of maintaining some stable lean body mass. And I feel bad for people because they're exposed to so much online that is not evidence-based.
Yeah.
But that's the world we live in. It's a role for dietitians to provide some balance to that.
Something you said made me think of my biggest myth buster, which has to do with your really high protein needs that dietitians can help people understand. And by the way, they change throughout treatment. So that is confusing. So it's important to have the personalized recommendations. And then the plant focus. You want to talk me through soy real quick?
Absolutely. One of my favorite things to talk about. It's all over the internet that soy contains estrogen. Estrogen feeds estrogen receptors. Therefore, you can't eat soy if you've had breast cancer or have a family history of it. And actually, science tells us the opposite is true. So the first thing to keep in mind is that, yes, plants have little bits of their own little hormones in them, just like we do. But the phytoestrogen, so, you know, phyto just means plant estrogens, are 100 to 1,000 times weaker than estradiol, which is the dominant estrogen that women are exposed to. And structurally, they're not the same. So there have now been several large population studies, yes, in Asia, where we know they start eating soy at a young age and they get less breast cancer. And when they get it, it tends to be less aggressive. Unfortunately, that data changes. My understanding is within like a generation of moving to like the United States, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
But we have several large, diverse population studies that have found that women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer who eat soy food don't do worse and may actually do better. And really interestingly, some of the stuff I've read suggests that this fact that these phytoestrogens look sort of like estrogen might be that they can kind of hog the estrogen receptor ports, but they're not potent like estradiol. So the association I always use with patients, that it just works perfectly. It just does. I'm like, you know, when you have little kids in the house and you buy those outlet protectors, those plastic things, and you put them in the outlet so that the kid can't stick a fork in there and get electrocuted. So the outlet protector is covering the outlet, but it's not conducting electricity. So it could be that phytoestrogens actually do the same thing. And as a plant source of protein, that's great for your health in a lot of ways. The same stuff circles around in the fertility world, when in fact, including soy foods is actually found to be good for your fertility. But a lot of like, you know, again, it's a hormone realm. Soy foods contain estrogen. And they, you know, they have people saying a lot of what sounds like convincing stuff online to tell you that they're bad for you, and they're not bad for you. They're actually good for you. And that includes in people with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer.
Yeah, I had a physician tell one of my clients the other day that she should avoid soy. She has estrogen positive. She's a breast cancer survivor. And one of the dietitians on staff there heard about it and said, I'm going to have to step in and do an education for all the physicians here, because we all need to be on the same page. We all need to be evidence-based. And it's really important that we're all giving the same message, because fear of food is so dangerous in our cancer survivor population.
Oh, God.
And it causes so much anxiety and stress. I think it makes everything worse. It has people going on really restrictive diets when their needs are going up. And one thing that I talk a lot about, and I'm interested if you do, is orthorexia, which is on the eating disorder spectrum,
yeah.
Right? And it's not like anorexia nervosa, which is losing weight because of the desire to do so. It's losing weight uncontrollably because of being afraid of food, basically. Is that how you describe it?
Even if someone did not have a pre-existing paranoia associated with too many aspects of food, having a cancer diagnosis may exacerbate that. And then you have a person in a position where they're having difficulty, as you said, meeting their calorie and protein needs and afraid of like certain fruits and different vegetables and don't eat this and don't eat that. And all of it just institutes fear, which is stressful. It's stressful to be afraid of everything that you put in your mouth. On that similar line, what we often have to deal with is the patient might be kind of okay with doing whatever feels right, but they have friends and family members and people that are online the minute they get a cancer diagnosis. And we know that they're doing it because they love this person and they're afraid, but now they're shooting their person this link and that link and texting this article. And the person, they come to us to be talked off the ledge a lot of times.
Yeah.
So we literally have like a packet. It's designed to be something that you share with your tribe that says, I understand you guys want to make me meals and this meal trains and all that cool stuff. And to communicate what kind of foods they're tolerating so they don't end up with like 10 pans of lasagna. We put at the end a little paragraph that says, we know you mean well, but please don't slam your family, your loved one with lots of links about nutrition.
Yeah.
We're happy to talk to you about anything that you might have concerns about, but it adds a layer of stress about, oh my God, am I killing myself if I eat a Snickers bar?
Yeah.
It's really one of the more upsetting things. Very rarely, thankfully, but occasionally we have to be that person that's almost mediating between the patient and the loved one who may be the orthorexic one.
Relationship to food and body needs to be part of the conversation as you go through cancer treatment and beyond.
Right, because people come into the experience with the same everything they had before. It doesn't just flip because now you have cancer.
Right.
I always say to the head and neck population, like, I love the foodies because most people live to eat. You know, we're supposed to. We're supposed to have a healthy relationship with food. But when I get somebody who has that eat to live kind of personality where food doesn't really do that much for them, at baseline, and now so many cancer treatments, for example, cause taste changes. I think taste changes are the most difficult side effect to deal with.
Yeah.
Because it completely messes with your brain's take on what that thing is supposed to taste like when I put it in my mouth. So if you're somebody who's not that interested in eating on a good day, anybody works with oncology populations knows people like, you're trying to tell me I have to start eating mini meals starting at breakfast and I haven't eaten until 2 o'clock. 30 years.
Right.
You know, so we have to deal with what they came into the experience with. We can't just like throw pixie dust in their face and say, you will now be somebody who eats 5 times a day.
Yeah, it's really hard to shift who you've always been because you need to for therapeutic reasons. And one thing I know you and I and your team of dietitians are so good at is personalizing recommendations. So you listed the 8 evidence-based, this is the truth, we know it over years and hundreds of thousands of pieces of research. How do you take all of that and personalize it to each person in front of you?
A lot of it depends upon what is happening with the patient. I had a conversation with a patient the other day who has so many side effects. She's taken an oral therapy for lung cancer and she has no appetite and her taste is altered and she's exhausted. She's lost a ton of weight. She lost a lot of muscle. And I was really meeting her where she is and say, there's time for us to talk about nutritional quality. It seems to me the best first approach is to just get you eating more regularly.
Right.
So in those instances, we may be just saying, what is it that's the least offensive to you right now? If you're going to start eating at a certain time, and we do a lot of mini meal counseling, and it might be little snack combinations, ideally trying to get a protein in there and a carbohydrate at least. That's where taking the pulse of the person and what they're experiencing. Because I always say to people, calories are number one and protein is right behind it. But people often times we'll get the protein message that they're not eating enough calories. And we all know what happens when you eat protein. It makes you feel fuller faster, keeps you feeling fuller longer. So I know it's a very non-specific answer, but it really is personalizing it.
Yeah.
If someone comes into it with good, healthy eating habits, then we may just review what they're doing and reinforce all the good stuff they're doing and tweak something, maybe review a protein goal with them and encourage them to kind of, whenever you eat a meal or a snack, try to get some protein in there. We do a lot of hydration talk, a lot of hydration counseling. People come in so many shapes and sizes and personalities and pre-existing levels of education. That's what makes it interesting.
I have people bringing in backpacks full of supplements, and it's my favorite situation in the whole world because I love going through them and educating and talking about them. How do you handle the supplement conversation in your work?
I feel like my job is to interpret what they're doing. And if I'm not worried about what you're doing, I'm not going to try to take it away from you. So our job is to express things that we may have concerns about or that we don't know about. So yes, we have a subscription, a site license at Dana-Farber. Any computer will get you to the Natural Medicines database and you can look up different supplements. But the conversation, I generally just kind of funnel it right to say, listen, I could give your list of supplements to my intern and have them look up all of these things and tell you the nutrient drug interactions and the potential areas of concern. I said, but I'm telling you right now, nobody is ever going to do the studies that are going to say, with your genetics and your cancer and your treatment protocol, that we have any idea what happens when all these supplements meet up in your liver or someplace else, because it's not going to happen. It never has happened. And it can be a distraction from the food stuff that we know to be true. We also have concerns like you alluded to. We had two parallel studies, the Mr. Fit study and the Finland study or whatever, where they gave men who smoked beta carotene supplements, and both trials were ended early because the smokers were getting more lung cancer.
Right.
So we know that it may be possible to protect abnormal cells from targeted destruction by your immune system by overloading your system with too much antioxidant nutrients. So these things aren't necessarily benign. So I feel like I used to have these conversations more than I do now. Like most people are looking to get let off the hook from taking all of these supplements.
Okay. Yeah.
And they appreciate an open conversation. But one thing that makes dietitians unique and we should be proud of is we tell people, I don't know. When they go to some other types of providers or some online resources and people make all kinds of super bold-faced promises about if you do this, this is going to happen, I find it shocking. But what makes us unique is we have to take like multiple semesters of chemistry and inorganic, organic, biochemistry, nutrition, metabolism, so that we understand how complicated the body is.
I was lucky enough too, in my master's in nutrition program, I got to take a full course on supplements specifically.
It really
changed the way that I understand them, quality, the background, the laws. It was really fascinating. So yeah, dietitians are unique in that space.
I mean, for sure, there are a lot of people taking omeprazole in the cancer care world. Prilosec interferes with B12 absorption.
Yeah.
Higher risk of B12 deficiency. Anybody on metformin, increased risk of B12 deficiency. As we get older, we don't absorb B12 from food as much. Synthetic is absorbed better. You know, I recently had a back and forth with the radiation oncology nursing team to make sure, as you said, that we were saying the same thing. What do you guys tell people about vitamin D and multivitamins? And they say, we tell them a multivitamin that is up to about 100% of the RDA for the various nutrients or vitamin D supplement is fine. We tell them not to take high dose antioxidants. But there still are clinicians that are telling people, oh, you got to stop that calcium and vitamin D while you're getting radiation. Well, they're not antioxidants, and I don't know why you have to. So we all have to continue to learn along the spectrum, and it is confusing to people when different people around the treatment world are telling them different things.
And what I really like about your message here is the ongoing push for personalization and looking at each person's individual case and what they might benefit from. That's really the bottom line.
Dietitians are so good at genuinely expressing that we care about what happens to you. You know, we have more time to listen to what they actually care about, what's important to them, what they think they can do. You know, it's so important for us to be non-judgmental. And that's, again, what allows us to really bond with our patients, because if they don't like you, they're not coming back. And that's why I think dietitians are so good at connecting with our patients on this thing that's so integral to day-to-day life, survivorship, and just enjoyment of food, you know?
I'm really glad to hear you sharing that message. I feel the same way. But Hillary, wrap me up today and tell me three things that I, in my 40s, can do right now, diet and lifestyle-wise, to reduce the risk of developing cancer at some point later in life.
Three things. So the first would be regular physical activity. Again, it is one of the most studied cancer prevention survivorship strategies that exists. So that is just aiming at baseline. If you want to do more, fine. But that 150 minutes of some sort of cardio type activity, like walking, jogging, cycling, swimming, pickleball, whatever it is that you're into, 150 minutes a week and at least two episodes if not three, of strength training on non-consecutive days. Mm. There's so much bang for your buck on so many levels of health. The second is to really take a hard look at, am I eating as much of a plant-based diet as I think? In my experience, when I talk to people about plant-based eating, people will often describe eating fruits and vegetables. But when you get into it, you realize they're kind of practicing around the edges. They may eat them, but not necessarily the volume that the research tells us can make a clinically meaningful difference in your health. So if we look at what is plant-based eating, kind of at its bare bones, roughly 2 to 4 servings of fruit, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables, at least 3 servings of whole grains. Write down what you're eating for a few days and see, am I doing that? I'll make tips like try to have 1 fruit in the first half of the day, 1 fruit in the second half of the day. You're at that 2 out of 2 to 4. If you eat more, great. But really see, is the volume of plant foods I'm eating actually clinically meaningful? And the third thing I think is obvious, don't smoke cigarettes, don't drink too much alcohol, don't smoke a lot of pot, just kind of appreciating this is the one body we have and we just don't want to overexpose it to environmental things that we can more easily recognize as controllable, because we're clearly exposed to a lot in the environment that we actually don't really fully understand yet.
Hillary, this has been one of my favorite conversations. It was such a joy to spend some time with you, and thank you for all the work you've done in this space and for women's health. It's incredible.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this. I'm very passionate about it, as you can tell.
Yeah, for sure. Me too. Our show is sponsored by Orgain and produced in collaboration with Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. To stay up to date on the latest podcast episodes, be sure to follow. If you like this podcast, I'd love for you to let me know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or you can give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching right now. I'm Ginger Holton. You can find me online at gingerholton.com. Thanks so much for listening.